From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I see this as an outrageous attempt to intimidate me and other scholars from participating in the public debate and to have a chilling effect on all researchers and all scholars who get involved in issues examining corporate behavior in today's society.
What happens when the country's largest nursing home chain sues an academic for testifying against its labor practices? A conversation with the brother of one of the U.S. nuns killed in El Salvador by the U.S.-backed military. And a leading British peace activist speaks out. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. President Clinton has decided to permanently ban a practice that has allowed the importation of popular semi-automatic assault weapons such as the AK-47 and the Uzi, closing what he regards as a major loophole in the nation's gun control laws. As many as 1.6 million rifles for which permits are pending or already have been issued would be blocked from entering the country by the executive order Clinton is scheduled to announce at a White House ceremony today. President will declare that 59 models of military-style rifles previously certified for import because they've been modified to be used for sporting purposes will now fall under laws and regulations banning assault weapons. Major restrictions on the importation of foreign-made assault weapons were first imposed in 1989 after a schoolyard shooting in Stockton, California. In 1994, Congress enacted a broader prohibition on the manufacture, sale, and possession of most assault weapons that included a ban on the production of large-capacity magazines that can hold 10 or more rounds of ammunition. President Clinton has asked the Justice Department to consider a request from the family of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. to open a new investigation of the civil rights leader's assassination 30 years ago, this according to a senior White House official. Rahm Emanuel, a senior advisor to the president, says Clinton will convey that news to Coretta Scott King, who last week made a public request to Clinton to appoint a commission to examine what she said. What she said was new evidence regarding her husband's killing. While President Clinton grapples with numerous sex charges, more than 6 in 10 top corporate officers don't think similar conduct would be tolerated in their offices. This according to Investor's Business Daily today. In fact, 2/3 say they doubt they'd be able to keep their jobs if several of their employees charge them with sexual misconduct. For nearly 3 decades, a California state legislative committee spied on 20,000 Californians, documenting their personal habits, social lives, and political and professional relationships. For almost as long, the information, held in 80 cartons, have been gathering dust in the state capitol archives. Now the California Senate is deciding whether to allow historians to see the files, which are compiled by the California Senate Fact-Finding Subcommittee on Un-American Activities. Though the material could provide an invaluable window on the workings of the subcommittee, some people who've examined the documents are concerned about the release of potentially embarrassing information. The subcommittee's investigation began in 1939 and continued through the 1960s. Among the materials compiled were notes on index cards, investigators' diaries, memorandums, newspaper clippings, and notes of recorded conversations, until the California legislature disbanded the panel and ordered its findings sealed in 1971. The Reverend Henry Lyons, the embattled leader of one of the nation's largest black denominations, encountered protests this weekend at a church whose pastor invited him to speak. Lyons, president of the National Baptist Convention USA, Inc., is charged with grand theft and racketeering for allegedly skimming millions from the convention. Members of the Mount Olive Tabernacle Baptist Church in West Philadelphia rebelled when their pastor invited Lyons to address the Independent Ministers Conference in Philadelphia, a new alliance of Pennsylvania ministers. Ken Hall, a Teamster leader from Charleston, West Virginia, announced yesterday he will run against James Hoffa Jr. for the presidency of the Teamsters. Hall was co-chair of the Teamsters Negotiating Committee during last summer's strike against United Parcel Service of America. Hall was close to Ron Carey, who was forced out of the presidency because of illegal contributions made to his election campaign in 1996. Carey narrowly defeated Hoffa in that campaign. The upcoming election will determine who serves out Carey's term. In this news from Indonesia, as protests against the dictator Suharto continue in the streets of Indonesia, the government has called on universities to enforce a ban against campus political activity. And one of China's few active dissidents has been sentenced to 2 years in a labor camp just months before a visit by President Clinton. Authorities told Sheng Liangqing's mother that he was being punished for contacting foreign human rights groups and reporters. This according to the Hong Kong-based Information Center of Human Rights and Democratic Movement in China. Meanwhile, jailed student protest leader Wang Dan is not optimistic about his prospects for release soon, despite rumors of a Chinese deal with the United States to win his freedom, this according to his mother. U.S. officials in Washington last week said they're pushing for Wang's release on medical parole before President Clinton visits Beijing in late June for a summit with Chinese President Jiang Zemin. And that's some of the news at this hour. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! And before I became voice challenged last week, I had a chance to talk to an academic in Ithaca, New York, who works at Cornell University, about a very interesting case that seems to be a trend in this country when corporations take on academics or activists, in this case, the largest nursing home chain in the country, suing a Cornell University researcher. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. And we noticed a very interesting piece in the New York Times the other day. It says, in an unusual case pitting a claim of defamation against defense of academic freedom, a labor relations professor at Cornell University is being sued for slander by the nation's largest nursing home company. The company, Beverly Enterprises, which operates more than 700 nursing homes, says the professor, Kate Bromfenbrenner, defamed it when at a town meeting in Pittsburgh last year, she declared that Beverly was one of the nation's most notorious labor law violators. You may remember on Democracy Now!, just a few months ago, we talked to Professor Bromfenbrenner about a report she had put out on NAFTA. She had been contracted by the U.S. government to look at the effects of NAFTA. But this is a very different story, and we've got Professor Bromfenbrenner on the phone right now. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good day.
Professor Bromfenbrenner, can you tell us what this case is all about? What happened when you spoke in Pittsburgh a few months ago?
I was in May of 1997, actually. I was invited by Congress to testify as an expert witness at a congressional hearing in Pittsburgh about legislation to bar major labor law violators from getting federal contracts. And this hearing, I was asked to testify about whether Beverly Enterprises, one of the nation's most major labor law violators, was aberrant employer or whether they represented the norm for employer behavior in union campaigns. So I testified for less than 10 minutes. I was not asked any questions after my testimony. Nothing about my testimony was reported in the newspaper. I went home and didn't hear anything. And then on February 9th, I learned from an AP reporter that Beverly Enterprises had filed a defamation suit against me in federal court based on my testimony at this congressional hearing.
What evidence do you have that Beverly is one of the nation's most notorious labor law violators?
What I testified is based on my research that has been conducted over the last 10 years, a national study of employer behavior in union campaigns. This is research that has been published in refereed journals and in books. It was research that I've been called upon to testify by government on many occasions about. It's considered, you know, the largest national study of employer behavior. And my testimony was based both on my research and the public record.
So what does this lawsuit mean for you? What is Beverly Enterprises asking for?
Well, in addition to suing me for $250,000 and up, they also sent me a discovery demand asking for all of my data relating to my research, very confidential data that if it went into the hands of employers would be devastating for the labor movement and for my ability to ever do research in the future, because when I survey workers, as most researchers do, I promise them confidentiality and that only the aggregate results would be reported, not individual data. I see this as an outrageous attempt to intimidate me and other scholars from participating in the public debate, from responding to requests from our government to investigate legislation, and also an attempt to get access to confidential data and to have a chilling effect on all researchers and all scholars who get involved in issues examining corporate behavior in today's society.
what do you think a judge would do? Would a judge allow in a pretrial discovery process that you turn over details of your years of research, the people you've spoken to, et cetera?
My hope is that the discovery process should not move forward. This is a frivolous suit that has no merit. Allowing the discovery process to go forward would threaten every scholar all over the country, and that's why more than 700 scholars have signed a letter of protest. People have gone before Congress. On Tuesday, there was a congressional briefing about just this issue, what it means about researchers and speaking publicly and testifying in public forums. My hope is it wouldn't go forward. I know that they also sued the president of an SEIU local. They sued her last August for testifying at the same hearing, and a federal judge dismissed the case against her because you're supposed to have testimonial immunity when you testify before Congress. Beverly's appealing that decision to the circuit court. My hope is that this case would also, in my case, be thrown out both for testimonial immunity and also as an abridgment of my freedom of speech and my academic freedom.
SEIU being the Service Employees International Union that has been waging the battle to unionize Beverly Enterprises, the Beverly Nursing Homes.
That's right.
It's not only you who have criticized Beverly Enterprises. The SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, have brought unfair labor practices charges against them in a number of cases. And also in 1995, the General Accounting Office, the auditing and investigative arm of Congress, identified Beverly as one of the 15 companies guilty of more serious labor law violations. And last November, an administrative law judge describing wide-ranging and persistent misconduct said Beverly had violated the law by failing to reinstate hundreds of strikers at 20 nursing homes. The judge wrote of coercive tactics such as blatant surveillance of union activities, threats of retaliation, suspensions, and discharges of union supporters. In your research, is this what you have found?
The pattern of Beverly's behavior is supported by my research, the research of others, the public record, the NLRB record. What I have said, similar things have been said in the media, have been said in court cases, have been said by congressmen, and at the hearing that I testified at, I was one of many people who testified. Other scholars testified, people from the Veterans Administration, retirement groups, patients, workers. Many people are speaking out about corporate behavior, and when corporations not only flagrantly violate the law, but also really go beyond the pale in terms of how they treat their workers who try to exercise their rights under the Act.
Kate Bronfenbrenner, you are an untenured professor at Cornell University. What has been the university's response to this lawsuit?
I'm actually not a professor. I'm in a research director position, and maybe Beverly thought that would mean that Cornell would not represent me, but Cornell is representing me to the fullest. The Cornell Counsel's Office is handling my case and supporting me in every way.
But aren't they in some way actually winning in that? Do you feel now constrained about talking about Beverly Enterprises?
There's no question. I've been sued in a multimillion-dollar lawsuit. I am very concerned. I can't talk about the facts of the case. This has taken up hours and hours of my time. So instead of doing my research, I'm having to deal with a lawsuit. It is very frightening, stressful. And what I have discovered is that it has not only had an impact on me, but I've talked to hundreds of scholars across the country who've written me, called me, and all of them are very afraid. They are afraid of stepping forward and testifying. But this isn't just about speaking at government hearings. This is about writing, about releasing your research in journals, speaking about it in lectures. People are afraid to research corporations, afraid that they too will be hit with a harassment suit. And just because the suit has no merit, it still can have a devastating effect on your life. And seriously hinder your ability to do research in the future, because who is going to reveal the information to me if they know that a corporation might take that research and get their names and find out what they said to me in the future?
I have a question which you may think is a bit far-fetched, but we interviewed you a few months ago because you had been contracted with by the U.S. government to look at the effects of NAFTA, and you found that NAFTA had meant a loss of jobs in this country. The government would not release your report. You made this report public. Could this be in some way some kind of retaliation against you, although this isn't the U.S. government that's doing this suit, it's Beverly Enterprises?
The only thing I think any of this is related is that because organizing is a hot issue, because there have been a lot of investigations into it, my name has been out there publicly a lot. I've been quoted in the media. I've been asked to testify a lot. And so if Beverly succeeds in intimidating me and shutting me up, then it has a ripple effect far beyond me because I'm well known and because I'm out there.
What are your plans right now? What is the course of this suit?
Well, I'm trying to do my job, and we are proceeding forward with the suit. It takes a long time. This is in federal court. You know, this can take months, if not years. Beverly is already appealing the decision of the federal court in the case against Rose Trump, the president of the SEIU local. So it's clear they're going to challenge us all the way to the top. This could take years. And we just proceed forward and move along.
I understand that even organizations like ours interviewing you could be subpoenaed as a result of this lawsuit. Is that true?
Now, well, we know from what's been happening in Washington that the powers of subpoena are very broad, and it's quite possible that anybody could be subpoenaed or deposed in a lawsuit. That's how court cases work.
Beverly Enterprises said that your charges were unfounded. What's your response to that?
Everything I said in my testimony that I've said in my research is based on very careful, well-founded research and the public record, and everything I said was true.
And what evidence do you have that people who have talked to you confidentially about the situation at Beverly Nursing Homes would be hurt if you had to pass their names over to Beverly?
Beverly Enterprises is part of a large number of corporations who have been actively attempting to thwart unionization. And the information I have data on union organizers and union campaigns all across the country that corporate America would love to have to hurt union efforts. And there's no question that this information should not fall into the hands of those who oppose unions.
Well, Kate Bronfenbrenner, I want to thank you very much for taking time out of your day, since you have this added burden of dealing with a lawsuit, to speak to our listeners around the country on Democracy Now! Is there anything people can do at this point? We've covered slap suits in the past, these suits against activists and academics that take a lot of your time, though they're ultimately thrown out of court. They also take a lot of money. What can people do?
I think people have to continue to be willing to speak out, to seriously question the behavior of institutions in this country, and not let this kind of action intimidate them from taking part in public debate.
Is Beverly Enterprises around the country?
Yes, it's one of the largest healthcare corporations in the country.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
Kate Bronfenbrenner is director of the Labor Education Research at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. Coming up on Democracy Now!, we'll be talking about NATO expansion as President Clinton presses for the Senate to ratify NATO expansion for Hungary, Poland, and Czechoslovakia. The Senate is continuing to stall a bit. We're going to hear from a leading peace activist in Britain, head of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, on the issue. He's opposed to NATO expansion. We'll also be talking to the brother of Edith Ford. She's one of the four U.S. churchwomen who were killed in El Salvador in 1980 by the U.S.-backed Salvadoran military. And we'll be speaking with the attorney for the U.S. churchwomen's families who went down to El Salvador just a week ago and talk to the four Salvadoran military National Guardsmen who were convicted of killing the church women. And ultimately, they said for the first time that they were following orders. They were following orders from above. While the church women's families have always said that, the National Guardsmen have never admitted that. We'll find out what this means and how it is that one of those superiors now lives in Florida. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A new report out in the New York Times last week said that U.S. arms contractors have spent $51 million to get the U.S. Senate to approve NATO expansion, an amount of money that dwarfs the lobbying efforts of any other industry, including tobacco. Arms manufacturers stand to profit billions of dollars from the sale of equipment if Hungary, Poland, and Czechoslovakia are allowed to join NATO. Under NATO rules, new members are required to upgrade their militaries and make them compatible with those of the military alliance. Despite the intense lobbying effort, the issue of NATO expansion remains stalled in the Senate, largely because of questions surrounding the cost. But there's also been substantial opposition to NATO expansion from the U.S. foreign policy establishment as well as peace groups. One of the leading opponents of NATO expansion has been the British Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, one of Europe's oldest and largest peace groups, founded nearly 40 years ago by such luminaries as philosopher Bertrand Russell. CND has some 40,000 members. Dave Knight, the chair of CND, spoke recently at a public meeting on NATO expansion.
CND, Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, has about 40,000 members across Great Britain. And therefore, although it's not the largest peace movement in the world, I think that goes to probably the peace movements in Japan, it certainly represents a substantial body of people. And we feel that that's the strength of our work, and that the only reason that the British government and other governments, for that matter, take notice of us is because we represent a large number of people. And action and lobbying and education is the mixture we like to pursue. Ale, or when we talk to the Greens, of course, it's real ale. And because we feel that we can all have an effect. Every letter is an action, is something we say, so that if those of you who go away from this meeting feeling that we should do something about NATO expansion, the thing to do is to write a letter. And Jonathan's prepared a sheet which has addresses you can write to, and of course you can also write to the press. And as the Chinese proverb has it, it's better to light one candle than to curse the dark. So if you feel depressed, but you shouldn't after this, then write a letter and you'll feel a lot better for it. I'm the chair of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, which means that, as one of our local newsletters put it, I'm effectively the leader of the peace movement, the anti-nuclear movement in Britain. I'd like to take our topic tonight in three slices. I want to look at NATO expansion, NATO as a nuclear alliance, and even the existence of NATO, and would like to question even that, which probably wouldn't be comfortable with some of the people in this country, particularly who are against NATO expansion, because there's quite a lot of right-wing opposition to NATO expansion, which, of course, is down to the cost element. So what's wrong with NATO expansion? Well, firstly, it's bad for international relationships, particularly the relationship between the US and Russia. There is no doubt it's going to put back that opportunity that we had after the Cold War to build a different form of security in Europe. It's going to put back that building process by years, decades maybe. And the relationship between the US and Europe and between Europe and Russia is badly affected. It seems to me that that's no way to build cooperation. We want to be building cooperation and taking that opportunity to build a more secure Europe. And the cost element. The cost of NATO expansion is enormous. We're talking about billions, maybe tens of billions of dollars. And who's going to pay? Not Britain, not France. They're working as hard as possible to keep costs down so that they can join the single European currency. They can't afford to spend money on helping pay for NATO expansion. And they've said, we don't want to pay. The countries, Poland, Hungary and the Czech Republic, they can't pay. They want to spend what money they have on improving the healthcare, education, housing and so on. They can't afford to pay for NATO expansion. So who's going to pay? The US taxpayer. They're the only people who can pay. And it will be the taxpayer. And I'll come back to that in a moment. What else is wrong with NATO expansion? There's no clear policy. What is it trying to achieve? Okay. You ask diplomats and you ask even, if you like, the military. What are you trying to achieve with this expansion? What's the long-term goal? What's the strategy? There isn't one. It's just something that's happening. It seems to me, helping with, if you like, the rise of nationalism in Russia. It's giving an excuse to the nationalists in Russia. And also, and this is perhaps in some senses even more important, it's provoking a renewed reliance in Russia on nuclear weapons. A renewed reliance. Already, since the announcement of the expansion, the Russians have renounced their no-first-use policy. It's not that long since Gorbachev actually announced they would have a no-first-use of nuclear weapons policy. Now that's been renounced. And it's just part of a trend. And I won't go into details about START 2 and START 3, but it's quite clear that they're backing off. They're backing off from the negotiations, and why shouldn't they? If the United States doesn't want to cooperate in a positive way over security in Europe, there's bound to be a lot of suspicion there. Barbara Tuchman defined folly as the pursuit by governments of policies contrary to their own interests. And that seems to me what we have here. Why are the United States, and Britain for that matter, pursuing this policy when it seems such folly? And it is the US that's leading. Although I have to say there is no debate in Britain. There is no real political debate. We try to raise the question, and even the British government will talk about nuclear weapons. They say they don't want to, but if you talk to them about nuclear weapons, you get a response, you get into a dialogue. They won't talk about NATO expansion. It's there. It's going to happen. That's as far as they're concerned. So where does it come from? I will suggest three factors that are driving NATO expansion. The first is Cold War thinking. Cold War thinking in itself falls into, I would suggest, three categories. There's the ethnic fear of Russians. There are certainly ethnic minorities in this country who have a fear of the Russian, if you like, empire that was, okay, the Soviet Union, because of what happened in Eastern Europe and so on, in, if you like, the old days. And that, to some extent, is understandable. But when you add that to what I would call the redneck warriors in the United States, who have this Cold War thinking, which is based on, we were going forward, the Russians have backed off, we're going to keep on going forward. They don't say to where, all the way to the Chinese border? Maybe. The second is post-World War II guilt. And this is something that really hit Clinton. He was persuaded, it seems, to pursue NATO expansion because he started to feel guilty about what happened to Poland and Czech Republic and Hungary after the Second World War. That they, you know, America abandoned them, if you like, to Stalin. Okay, and now there's guilt. So we have to do something about it. Okay, we'll have them in NATO, and then we'll feel better. Second factor, I think, is the NATO gravy train. Okay, there's a lot of jobs, there's a lot of money, there's a lot of promotion in NATO. I'd like to quote to you Vice Admiral Shanahan, who says, "When I was a military advisor to the US permanent representative to NATO, I saw firsthand the rewards, the promotions, and the rigors, the meetings in which the biggest decisions was over who would provide the aircraft for the next fishing expedition." And a little story that might illustrate how money is wasted and how much people can make through NATO. There was an RAF expedition in Canada a few years ago, and an RAF sergeant who'd been on honeymoon in England before decided he wanted to give his company a good meal, and he'd actually been to this Indian restaurant that he thought was wonderful. So he rang up from Canada and said, "I'd like 55 takeaways, please. And could you bring them from England to Canada?" And they started. I don't know whether they arrived, but they were willing to spend the money to actually take those takeaways. It's just a waste of money. Thirdly, and in some ways, at the end of the day, the most insidious and probably the worst effect, and the thing that we will find more difficult to fight against and struggle against, and that's the arms exporters. There are billions of dollars to be made by the arms exporters. The costs that I talked about earlier is mostly made up from the re-equipping of the armies, the military, of the three new entrants. The word they're using is interoperable. All NATO countries have to have interoperable forces, even down to the tarmac on the runways. It has to be the right type so we know what's going to happen when the plane lands on it. There's billions of dollars to be made. And that's why the weapons manufacturers are leading the campaign for expansion. Bruce Jackson, have you heard of Bruce Jackson? Bruce Jackson is an American, and he's president of the US Committee to Expand NATO. Okay, seems all right. Why shouldn't someone be that? But he's also director of strategic planning for Lockheed Martin, the biggest weapons maker in the world. Now, he says he keeps the two things separate. Yeah, by day I'm one, by night I'm the other. No connection. Honest, no connection. Well, if you believe that, well, there you go. That's where the money's going, and it seems to me that's one of the prime reasons why it's just blasting on through. NATO is a nuclear alliance, and it's proud of it. NATO is proud to be a nuclear alliance. They have a first-use policy, always have. We will use nuclear weapons even against a conventional attack. That's always been NATO policy. And the International Court of Justice judgment, irrelevant. Okay. Don't worry about it. They've always been in the lead in development and deployment of new nuclear weapons. And they've always refused to negotiate nuclear weapons-free zones in Europe. I was talking with one of the ministers at the Foreign Office in Britain some weeks ago, and he said, yeah, this is the new Labour government. We think nuclear-free zones are wonderful, where appropriate. We don't think a nuclear weapons-free zone is appropriate in Europe. That's NATO speak. They don't want it. And quite clearly, there is at the moment a de facto nuclear weapons-free zone from the Baltic right down to the Black Sea, straight through Central Europe. And it's a wonderful thing to build on. What we should be doing is formalising that. We should be formalising that, and that will help, if you like, build out through the countries so we get a wider and wider nuclear weapons-free zone. And as Russia and America disarm in the way they say they're going to do, we build wider and wider and larger spaces of the world where there are no nuclear weapons. But what does NATO expansion do? It destroys it. It's more than the new states will have rights. They won't have rights, they'll have a duty. Now, although NATO said, oh, we won't put nuclear weapons on their soil, they could. They could do it without breaking any treaties as well. There are no treaties governing the tactical nuclear weapons in Europe. So they could be moved in straight away or at any time they wish. So what NATO expansion is doing is actually destroying what's already good that's there, as well as putting back negotiations towards a global abolition treaty by putting back the, if you like, the scaling down of the Russian and the American armories. I don't want to go into a catalogue of nuclear madness. I was going to mention the one. We were 2.5 minutes away from accidental nuclear war in January 95, I think it was. A couple of other ones you might like to know about. Just to show how nobody is in control of this nuclear madness. During the building of the Trident missile system in Britain, they lost 1,000 bits. Over the years they've been building it, they've lost 1,000 bits of the missiles or the submarines. Don't know where they are. Of course, US went one better. Did you know that the US lost the whole Trident sub for 9 days? No? In May last year, the Pentagon didn't know where one of its nuclear subs was. Sailed out of Hawaii, routine patrol, the captain misunderstood the orders, down to the bottom, easy alert, whatever they call it, and stayed there for 9 days. The Pentagon had no idea where this nuclear sub, this is a nuclear armed with Trident missiles, it didn't know whether they defected to somewhere, to whom. They didn't know if the captain had gone mad, he got the sack, of course, that's how it came to light later, or what had happened. But they had no control of that nuclear sub for 9 whole days. And just October last year, at RAF Wittering, which is a base in England, a Harrier jump jet which is a highly sophisticated machine, crashed in the RAF base, 200 yards from a nuclear warhead convoy. 200 yards from a nuclear warhead convoy that was parked there overnight. 200 yards, a lot nearer, and there would have been a mess all over England, and a big mess at that. Worse than that, in a sense, worse than the madness, is the fact that the nuclear weapons don't help. And this is the sort of question that Arlo was asking. Why this expansion? Why the nuclear weapons? The threats in Europe at the moment, ethnic unrest, if you like, terrorism, drugs, the governments of the Europe accept all these. Nuclear weapons don't help any of this. Don't help at all. So why am I against NATO existence, per se? Because it suggests that the only possible solution, or the ready solution, is a military solution. That's what NATO says. NATO is a military alliance. In Europe, we don't want to be building a military alliance. We want to be building a social, political, economic alliance. Now, if we actually used our money to do that, then it seems to me that we'd be making real progress. And we'd enhance security. The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, the OSCE, is there, totally underfunded compared to NATO, and is doing tremendous work in trying to help in situations where there is unrest, in trying to do conflict prevention and so on. Okay. The EU is developing as an economic unit, and if we worked with those two, we would be helping the security of Europe. But what happens? Well, the NATO is blocking the development of the OSCE because NATO, let's send the troops in. Let's have a military solution rather than another solution. And the European Union, what's happening? NATO is leading to the nuclearization of the European Union. The European Union is made up of countries, some of which are neutral, have no interest in nuclear weapons or anything like that. The European Union is becoming more and more nuclearized. Their attitudes are changing, and it's because of the existence and, if you like, the development of NATO that's happening. And NATO is working often in competition with the United Nations. What could be worse than that? If there's going to be any saving for the world, it's going to have to be through the United Nations. Of course, it needs reforming. It's not a great institution as it is. It needs reforming. But we've got to have a cooperative structure for the whole world, and NATO is working against that. Europe is a complex place. Oscar Wilde said, the truth is rarely pure and never simple. And just one example of that. Hungary and Romania have had problems between themselves. The relationship has been difficult for years over the Hungarian minority in Romania. And they were coming to an agreement. But if Hungary gets into NATO and Romania doesn't, that's over. And we have problems. NATO is too simplistic a solution, if it is a solution at all, for the situation in a place as complex as Europe. NATO expansion, it makes no sense socially, politically, economically. And it's going to put back development of security by years, if not decades. So we should be urging our governments to abandon this folly, even at this late date. There's a Russian proverb. No matter how far you've gone down the wrong road, turn back.
You've been listening to Dave Knight, chair of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, one of the Europe's oldest and largest peace groups in Britain. If you'd like a copy of today's show, call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Up next, we take a look at new revelations in the case of the four U.S. churchwomen killed in El Salvador in 1980.
There is money going overseas to buy changes that will never come. Dollar-backed contrast spill the blood of the people. In small nation we won't leave alone. There are contrasts in Nicaragua. train death squads in El Salvador. I hear Jonah Savimbi holding hands with apartheid is being led to drink at the trough.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. After 17 years of silence, all four of the former National Guardsmen convicted of killing three American nuns in El Salvador, as well as a lay worker in 1980, have said for the first time that they acted only after receiving orders from above. The declarations, made from prison, are an important development in the case because El Salvador and the United States have always officially argued that the killers acted on their own. Human rights groups and relatives of the victims, however, have always maintained that the executions were ordered, approved, and directed by the military authorities. The churchwomen, Maura Clark, Jean Donovan, Edith Ford, and Dorothy Cazell, were abducted, raped, and shot to death on the night of December 2, 1980. The next day, peasants discovered their bodies alongside an isolated road and buried their remains in a common grave. The van they'd been driving, when stopped at a military checkpoint, turned up 20 miles away, burned and gutted. The killings came as the United States was beginning a decade-long $7 billion input of money into El Salvador for both covert and overt aid. We're joined right now by William Ford. He is the brother of Edith Ford, one of the Mary Knoll nuns who were killed on that night. Welcome to Democracy Now!, William Ford.
Good morning.
Hi. First, what is your reaction to this new information that has come out?
Well, in a sense, it's not new. At the trial of the guardsmen in 1984, the guardsmen did not testify, but one of the defenses offered by their lawyers was that they were acting under higher orders, but that was ignored at the time by the U.S. government and the Salvadoran government. What we have now, some 17 and a half years after the crime, is a actual confirmation by these guardsmen, in their own words, that they have that they had higher orders. What is equally disturbing to me is the fact that these two generals from the Salvadoran Army, who were specifically named as participating in a cover-up in the State Department Tyler Report, are now freely living in the United States. And it is the family's belief that these men should be questioned very closely, because we believe it's likely that they either gave the orders or knew about the orders before the women were killed.
How did they get into the United States?
I don't know. I can only presume that as graduates and associate of the School of Americas, that they have a lot of contacts here with the U.S. military and were able to get in. And I think that the Immigration and Naturalization Service ought to pay some particular attention to these people, maybe use some of the efforts that it presently uses to hound people in factories, and they go after people who are implicated in the murders of U.S. citizens.
We're talking to William Ford, who, in addition to being the brother of Sister Edith Ford, who was killed in 1980 by the Salvadoran military, is also a New York trial lawyer. And we're joined by another attorney, Scott Greathead, who is one of two men, along with Robert Weiner, who went down to El Salvador last week and did the interview with the four Salvadoran National Guardsmen, where they each revealed that they had been told that they were doing this on higher orders. Now, he was working with Lawyers Committee for Human Rights, which has sent a letter to Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, urging the State Department to request the appropriate U.S. authorities conduct immediate investigation into how the former director general of the Salvadoran National Guard was permitted to become a resident of the U.S. Scott Greathead, welcome to Democracy Now! Do you have any idea at this point how he did come to be in the United States?
No, that's a mystery to us, but it was a shocking revelation, frankly, as Bill Ford just mentioned, in 1983, a long time ago. President Reagan sent a retired federal judge, Harold R. Clark, to Salvador to investigate what was going on in this case and what was going to be necessary to actually convict the five National Guardsmen who had been charged in it. And Judge Clark, after interviewing everybody who was involved in the case, wrote a report in which he said that the Director General of the National Guard, Vitas Casanova, was very evasive under questioning about what had been done to uncover the crime, and that he thought that it was quite possible that Vitas Casanova was involved in covering up the crime. Later, Vitas Casanova became the Minister of Defense. He was promoted to general and worked very closely with U.S. authorities during the course of the 1980s and dealing with the Civil War at that time. In 1993, as you probably know, the United Nations Truth Commission wrote another report on this case, and in which it included in much more definite terms that Vitas Casanova, as Director General of the National Guard, had been involved in covering up the crime. So there is no question that when this guy entered the country, the State Department and other government agencies knew he was involved, implicated in the murder of, or at least covering up the murders of, four U.S. citizens. So it's just a mystery and a shocking turn of events to learn that he's now residing here.
What about his cousin, Lieutenant Colonel Oscar Edgardo Casanova?
There is a lot of circumstantial evidence and some knowledgeable witnesses who have placed him at the center of the crime as the guy that, having been in charge, he was the colonel in charge of the of all military activities in the Zacatecoluca area where the crimes were committed. And many knowledgeable people, including the former head of ANSASAL, the Salvadoran Intelligence Agency, say it was he who actually ordered the murders. That's an issue that was never investigated by the Salvadoran military. And it is something that we believe ought to be investigated now. He, of course, is a cousin of Vitas Casanova, and it would have been presumably an incentive for Vitas Casanova to cover up the crime, possibly to protect his cousin.
And where is he right now?
We don't know where he is. The second person who's up here, however, is General Garcia, who was the Minister of Defense at the time of the murders. And in the UN's Truth Commission report, he is also implicated in the cover-up of these murders. So that is a second question we have, how General Garcia came to be living in the United States besides, despite this connection with the murder of four U.S. citizens.
Scott Greathead, one of the two lawyers working with the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights, who interviewed the National Guardsmen in El Salvador this past week, where he got them to reveal that, where in these interviews they revealed that they were responding to higher authorities when they killed the three U.S. churchwomen and a laywoman in El Salvador in 1980. What was that scene like in the prison when they said this for the first time in 17 years, though people like Bill Ford, Ida Ford's brother, have been saying this for a long time?
Well, we had to go to two different prisons. There were two in each of them. We interviewed them separately. They had varying attitudes. One was relatively forthcoming, quite sorry about his involvement in all this. Another one was simply angry that he'd been in prison for 17 years when, because of the amnesty in El Salvador, people who committed what he thought were similar crimes were out free. They each had different amounts of information they were willing to share with us, and I suspect they all have somewhat more information. All of them said they didn't know the identity of the person who gave the orders to their immediate superior, whose name was Subsergeant Kalindra Salomon. But we came away thinking that they probably have more information. They're undoubtedly motivated out of a desire to get their sentences reduced. They're serving 30-year jail terms. They've served about 17 years. And this is a process that we intend to pursue on behalf of the families.
William Ford, have you spoken to the State Department since this information came out on Friday?
No. The only thing I read was the statement by the spokesman for the State Department, James Rubin, talking about the confessions coming some 17 years later. What Mr. Rubin neglected to say was that the families have been trying for years to get a representative into the jails to interview these guardsmen, and that the State Department continues to withhold the evidence on which it says proves that there were no higher orders. So if Mr. Rubin and the State Department have information which proves their point being that there were no higher orders, 17 years later, it's time to show that information to the families and stop this shell game.
I know, William Ford, that you just mentioned School of the Americas, that some of these officers were trained at School of the Americas, and that your son, who is a high school teacher in New York, is involved in demonstrations for closing the School of the Americas. Can you elaborate further on who was trained at the Fort Benning School in Georgia of these Salvadoran officials involved in the deaths of your sister?
Well, my information, and Scott Greathead may have better, is that Vitas Casanova and Garcia had been invited to speak and have close associations with the school, and I think that Casanova may have attended classes at the school.
So these are the men that gave the orders?
These are the men who were certainly in the chain of command who actively sought after the crimes to cover them up, and who we believe may well have had knowledge before the murders were committed that they were going to be committed. Because as Scott said, Vitas Casanova's cousin, Edgardo Casanova, who was the head of the Zacatecoluca military district, which included the airport, was Vida's cousin, and there is a very close relationship among these Salvadoran officers. And the difficulty with the School of Americas is that, at least as far as the Salvadoran situation is concerned, that school was training military officers who were engaged in a war against their own people. The Salvadoran military was convinced that the guerrillas who were fighting them came from a certain population group, and that population group suffered terribly in free fire attacks, bombing, that kind of thing. So people come out of the School of the Americas thinking that the U.S. approves of these tactics. They get access to U.S. Military supplies, and they use it to kill their own people. It's a terrible cycle which has to be broken.
It's interesting that Salvadoran Colonel Carlos Eugenio Vidas Casanova, who was then the Director General of the National Guard and later Minister of Defense, is now residing in the United States when those that are protesting the School of the Americas, people like Father Roy Bourgeois, who has made it his life's mission, are sitting in jail.
Well, it's a bad situation. There are bills pending in Congress to close the school, and I hope that people who are listening to this program will take pen to paper and write to their representatives and senators to urge that the school be closed. These countries in Central and South America need educational and economic aid. What they don't need is more military and more money spent on defense.
In addition to pressing your urging listeners to press for the closing of the School of the Americas, let me ask both of you my final question, which is what else can people do now in regards to this former Minister of Defense in Salvador living in the United States and what you're calling for? Scott Greathead, let's start with you.
Well, I think first they can do what we did, which is write the Secretary of State and ask her to explain how they came to be here, and to see that the appropriate authorities investigate whether any United States laws were violated in the process. I mean, this is really, these are people who were involved at best in the cover-up of the murders of four U.S. citizens, and I think it raises questions about whether they came here in violation of any United States laws.
Now, this Salvadoran general didn't sneak into the U.S., right? He was granted residence.
No, everybody knows that he's here. Everybody, the embassy in Salvador knows he's here. Salvadorans who are close to this case and close to, you know, these kinds of issues know he's here. It apparently has been well known for a long time that they're both here.
And William Ford, brother of Sister Ida Ford.
Well, just continuing what Scott has said, I think that people should not only write to Madeleine Albright, but write to their congressman and ask why two men implicated in the murder and the cover-up of the murders of four U.S. Churchwomen are freely allowed to come into the United States, and why the U.S. Continues to foster the sale of arms and ammunition to these countries in Central and South America. These countries have no legitimate use for any further weapons, and that supply should just be cut off.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. Bill Ford, brother of Ida Ford and a New York trial lawyer, and also Scott Greathead, who is an attorney working with the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights, who interviewed the four National Guardsmen who admitted that they were acting on higher authority when they killed Ida Ford, as well as the three other church women, Maura Clark, Dorothy Cazell, and Jean Donovan. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can order a cassette from the Pacifica Archives by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin, our director, Errol Maitland, our engineer, Errol Maitland, and our director, Jeremy Scahill. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. Our webmeister is Michelle Garcia. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! And if you'd like to reach us by email, you can write democracy@pacifica.org.
As if it could be paid, but money borrowed.